Are you tired of working with generic IT providers that rely on you to be the expert? Arc IT goes beyond just fixing your tech headaches. They specialize in proactive IT management, BIM support, and data security for your architecture firm. The team at Arc IT gets your tech so you can focus on doing your best work. Whether you're a small firm of 10 or a growing practice with 50 or more employees, unleash the full potential of your creative vision with Arc IT. Visit getarcit.com and schedule your free IT assessment today. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Julia Nagel, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hi, Mark. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. Based in Seattle, Washington, Julia brings more than 20 years of experience to her role as Senior Principal and Director of Design at Hewitt Architecture. She believes the success of today's projects is based on the expertise of many and how well her studio expresses its core values of be smart, be creative, and be principled. Julia's leadership stems from these values as her team strives to address complex urban conditions in a straightforward and elegant manner. Her design approach in Hewitt's classic studio environment is similar to the project-based learning she leads as an affiliate assistant professor at the University of Washington's College of Built Environments. Redefining Seattle's skyline, Julia is known for her design of tall buildings. Julia's 40-story Emerald Tower, completed in 2020, is the tallest building on the West Coast, created by an all-female design team. Her innovative design for the 32-story Skyglass Tower just recently opened in early 2024, and the Mama Tower, which has completed the design review process and is now moving through permitting, maybe actually completed permitting. I'm not sure where we are in that timeline.
It's getting close.
When that project is complete, it will reach 484 feet. So when you're looking at the Seattle skyline, you're looking at a lot of Julia's work. And so this is an exciting conversation that I'm excited to have you here, Julia.
It was really good to be here.
Let me ask you, before we jump into tall buildings and the way you structure your design studio, which is a very interesting conversation as well. I'm looking forward to that. Let's learn more about you. When did you discover your passion for what you do, and who or what inspired you to get started?
There's different levels of that discovery, I think, that happen in different stations of life. You know, I went to undergraduate school at Lehigh University and University of Maryland for graduate school, and I was always interested in a creative field. I had sort of, you know, family values that were inherent in my sort of being raised. You know, one way I've heard a family member describe my parents is my mom was the clever one and my dad, you know, has a really good work ethic. They both are clever and both, you know, have a work ethic. But if you really had to boil it down to those two, I thought that was a pretty concise way to describe it. And when you think about those sort of two things, I think that lends itself well to pursuing a career in architecture. And I think maybe that...
What did they do for a living?
So I have sort of this interesting family where my mom's side of the family is very professional. I have a grandmother who became an MD in 1939. Wow. And also taught at Women's Medical College of Philadelphia. And you know, I lived with her a bit, actually, when I started my first job in architecture when I was 17, because I happened to have an uncle who was the design lead at his firm in Center City, Philadelphia. So I really did have that kind of fortunate opportunity where he gave me a job before I started undergraduate school at Lehigh. So my first experience in architecture was working in a firm doing everything from back in the day making blue line prints to scrubbing site plans with alcohol-based markers and all of those things. And I grew up working in studios and offices that, you know, the implementation of what we used to call computer-aided design to now what we call, you know, BIM, I was sort of experiencing that sort of change in the profession. And so I think there was sort of just rooted into the sort of the family ethos, you could say, that, you know, pursuing a creative career was something that was just as open to me to do and not discouraged than anything else. So that sort of led me into school. But I really would say, like, through school, I had moments of success and, you know, moments of sort of getting by. and throughout different stations of life and entering into the career, looking back, like what were those precise moments to go from sort of bobbing around sort of at an average sort of level of a staff person in various firms to being a director of design, working on tall buildings, teaching at the university. And that did have a certain moment, I think. And some of it is based upon, you know, we all have complex lives and there's a certain amount of faith and determination, self-determination that we have to sort of navigate these things in various ways. But you mentioned our core values. And, you know, one of the ways in which there was a real critical moment for me to really sort of, I think, change my perspective of career became one of our core values, which was to be smart. In 2014, I was working at Hewitt, so I was where I am here today. I was not a partner, but I was a day-to-day designer on what would be my first skyscraper, which was completed in 2020. It's called the Emerald. It's a 40-story building here in downtown Seattle. It's actually across the alley from my office window. And so, you know, when you're doing something right in your neighborhood, you really want to get it right. And it was probably a really formidable project in that the 40-story tower is on a site that's a regular shape because we have a street grid in Seattle that follows the shoreline. You know, until a certain point, it goes back to sort of cardinal points. So that irregular shape combined with the size of it, it was just over 7,300 square feet at the street level. And, you know, you add to it the seismic conditions that we have here in the city. And it was an integrated development agreement where we had to cantilever the building once it got to 125 feet to the neighboring building, it would cantilever over that. So it could be economically feasible. So it was sort of technically really challenging. So I was working on this project and we had a meeting. It was a really key meeting with the client group. And it was a complex client group that had representatives from Atlanta and Dallas. And they had a local representation. The development arm was here in Seattle. They were getting close to securing the permits. And so they really needed to not overpromise the city and have locked something into permitting without being within the budget. And we weren't within the budget. Again, it's a really challenging project. So people from Dallas and people from Atlanta and people from Seattle were going to have a large meeting with all the consultants in our conference room on a Thursday morning in March. I remember it. And it was essentially an audit of the project. When the meeting began, I sort of took note of, you know, the sort of ratio to men and women in the conference room. And it's not something that I could describe it as sort of a hostile experience that I've ever really had, but it's just something I kind of note. It was sort of 8-2. And so it wasn't bad. There was an electrical engineer who was female as well. And the meeting starts. So they audited all of the different consultants, so structural, mechanical, electrical. And then as we sort of finished with their portions of their scope, it was architectural. So hours later, I found myself being the only representative of design with representatives on the client side from Dallas and Atlanta. So it was 5-2 at that point. And my partner, Sean, had moved on to go explore some of the site conditions with the development group. And again, the reason for the meeting was the budget was not in line and the client was not happy. And so the construction representative from Dallas was decided to sort of pepper me with questions about the design. You know, how, what's the slope of the angle of the alley? What's the floor-to-floor height of the mechanical mezzanine? You know, why did you position this column here? You know, on and on and on to where, you know, I've been around a while to where, you know, when a meeting goes from problem solving in a sort of collegial manner to posturing, and that's where this went. And I went from answering questions that I didn't see so much as being asked in good faith to challenging, and he really didn't like that either. And it came to a point where he stopped his sort of rapid fire questioning and looked up at me and he says, "You're all making my nutsack hurt."
Wow.
It was a moment for me to sort of, you know, in Sheryl Sandberg lean in kind of thing, but it was not a great moment in lean in history at all. All I could do was sort of try to keep my composure and get out of the meeting.
Yeah.
Which I eventually did. And what happened was I made my way to the alley, you know, beeline to the alley, and I was just going to go for a walk. I left the meeting and that's all I could do is to go for a walk and just regain my composure. What happened, and that was like the extent of my plan, right? Is just not lose it in the office.
Right. I could imagine the amount of anger that was going through your mind. And
there was a lot of frustration, and it wasn't just for this person from Dallas. I mean, again, it's sort of the cumulative experience of, you know, adversarial relationships with whether it's a consultant, the contractor, in-house sort of situation. And really is, if you want this to be successful, well, let's solve problems and let's, why are we posturing, right? So there's a bit of that. But during my walk, what I learned was the walk turned into three stages. And the first stage was just to regain my composure. And it was March and it was Seattle. And fortunately, it was actually a sunny day out. And even more fortunately, I ended up having a pair of sunglasses in my coat pocket. And so what I learned, so pro tip for people, if you're having a really bad day and you have to go out for a walk and under those circumstances, you can put on your sunglasses and you can walk and cry at the same time and no one's going to know different.
Yeah.
So that was really, really successful part of the walk. But the second part of the walk really turned in, well, what actually happened in that meeting? Sort of, I went through it in my mind that there was a $7 million overrun in the budget and I couldn't figure out why those dollars were being, in the perspective of the representative from Dallas, it was the sort of Canton shift of the tower form that was causing this budget, which budget sort of overruns that I knew wasn't. But what was it really? What actually happened? Why did he keep going on about a specific dollar amount that could not be represented in the same wall area, sort of being in one position versus another position? And so I ran through my mind and I came to the conclusion, if I sort of pace back of sort of what we were being asked from Seattle, that we were asked to design a bigger building. We were asked to increase the average unit size. We were asked to add a half floor of above grade parking. We were asked to add some more amenity program. And I hazard a guess that Seattle wasn't talking to Dallas and Dallas wasn't talking to Atlanta. And Atlanta wasn't talking to Seattle. There's a miscommunication on the client side. So this is the really important part of the walk. And this is the one that sort of shaped into sort of the core value is, what was I going to do about it, right? And what I decided that needed to be done is I needed to track back all of the communications, all of the spreadsheets, all of the sort of cost analysis that was available historically from the last time there was a cost estimated to where we were today to determine my theory was correct, that we were asked to design a larger building and therefore it led to a more expensive building, but there was also a larger amount of revenue generation engine happening in it because it was a more rentable area. So this is a Thursday and I spent my entire weekend ruminating and going through all of that. I sort of put together all the information, get back to the office Monday morning, and I'm sitting at the copying machine waiting for my prints to come out, the spreadsheets and the comparison between this point in time versus that point in time. And the founder of the firm, David Hewitt, comes up to me and I'm literally looking at the printout and he says, "What are you doing?" And I go, "You know, I don't know," right? "And we have a second?" And I said, "Sure." And he was taking me to the conference room, the one-on-one conference room where either really good news or bad news was known to happen in the office. So we were walking there. I was thinking the client had maybe complained to David and he was going to tell me he was going to remove me from the project. And so, you know, I was sort of bracing myself for that news. And I get to that conference room and he sits me down. I was not removed from the project. I was asked if I wanted to be partner.
Oh, wow.
In the firm.
Talk about an emotional roller coaster.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And for those that are karma seekers, what ultimately happened with the project was we did secure our permits. We did get it in budget. That original client had sold the project to another owner who actually made a lot of good decisions to change the design to make it much more urban and architecturally friendly. So removing some of the parking, adding more units, places for people to live. And the building got built under this new ownership and Mr. Nutsack was never heard from again. So I think that was sort of a really thing. But the point here is like when we say be smart in our studio, we mean to command with authority your tasks and responsibilities. That was my shortcoming at that meeting with Mr. Nutsack and from Dallas, is I was not commanding with authority the tasks and responsibilities to know that we were asked to design a bigger building and that, you know, if I could have pointed that out, that that was what was sort of triggering the cost increase. The percentages were the same, that we could have foregone, you know, some of those exchanges that became pretty terse. So, you know, we talk about sort of how do you go from being successful enough to having a career in architecture to, you know, leading projects that can have some real challenges in them. That's what I think really helped me is this idea that you really need to command with authority your tasks and responsibilities, really need to be smart. And that's what we ask everyone in our studio to do, whether you're in administrative position or whether you have my job or Sean Ludvigson's job, who's also the partner in my firm who leads the studio, is we all need to command with authority our tasks and responsibilities.
And that takes a lot of proactive intentionality. It's not just a word, right? It's clearly what you're describing, it's not just a word on the wall, right? Sometimes you see principles, oh yeah, we have our core values and there's the core values and no one even pays attention to them. But this is clearly something that's part of the culture of your firm now. Can you talk about that a little bit and how you take it from that idea and that concept to embedding it into the culture of the practice?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right that the core values we did not have, we do have them printed out and they are sort of over on a wall, but they aren't sort of a result of hiring a consultant or having an executive coach or things like that. We sort of really look back at our life experiences and what were those important moments? What would you want to tell your own 25-year-old self or your 30-year-old self or when you're first starting out? What information we want to tell them that helped you? And part of it is, yes, we want excellence in our firm, but you know, I don't want my sort of designers to be in the position that where I was having an ugly meeting like that. So there's a lot of that involved. It's like, I'd rather, you know, share your experience of what helped you so they can avoid some of that. But yeah, so we do call our studio a studio, you know, and we do use our language of core values, be smart, be creative, be principled in sort of everyday language because they're everyday sort of guidance for us. When I interview for people, prospective candidates, I will often tell them about our core principles, but also say that they're also a representation of what pathway to success means in our studio. If you can express in your own way, depending on your station in your career and what it is that your particular role is, if you can be smart, creative, and principled as we sort of define them, you'll be successful. No question about it. With a studio, sort of a classic design studio format, you know, that's kind of based upon, again, sort of my past experience with the various number of offices that I worked in, that I was very familiar, I think we all are who study architecture, what being in studio means. You know, it's these sort of places where good messes can happen. And there's the sort of the physical reality of pinning up space and your work is all public. You sort of have a, you know, all of your work is seen by your peers, you have juries, you know, which is really important because when you build buildings, it's out in the landscape. Whether you have a background in architecture or not, people are going to, you know, have an opinion and it's going to be part of their experience. And that's valid, that there's a reality to that. So there's the, when we think about what does the professional practice studio look like for us, how do we take some of that spirit that was in the studio in school and sort of refashion it into a professional practice version of that? And so obviously, yes, the physical space to have pinup, the design methodology to have even crude models, even what we would describe as talking props, we see as valuable, whether we use things and we have in the past Lego or anything that is actually going to be effective. We don't care if it's high tech or low tech, as long as it's effective tech for us. That's part of what studio means to us. But probably the number one thing that means studio to us is project-based learning. Like, what do we learn from the work that we do and how can that support our future work? And I think that's the fundamental idea of studio in school is project-based learning and how can we use project-based learning. So some of the things that we'll do is why not organize our work not by, you know, building type or geographical location, but organize it by ideas. And sort of, and we've done that. So we sort of have like these 7 ideas, and there's going to be more, hopefully more as we continue to move forward. 7 ideas that we found, we think creates a positive impact that's focused on a sort of human condition that also supports the realities of what we describe as the real estate development economic ecosystem. You know, your ideas can't be detriment of that reality of the business models of your client, but it has to support that. And so we sort of think about our project-based learning of like, what are the ideas of our work? And we describe them as, in our mission statement, we seek innovative solutions as kind of some of the operative language in our mission statement, why our studio exists. We want to seek innovative solutions through our collective expertise. Collective expertise means studio to us within the urban experience. But what does innovation mean for us? And for us, it's these ideas of applied innovation, right? So if you think about fine art or applied art has these sort of really practical, functional sort of requirements to them, which we think is very complementary to architecture. And so we use that kind of ideas, like what are these down-home, very practical kinds of almost foundational concepts that we've learned to be useful and valuable to the client and their business model, but also be impactful to the urban condition. So, for example, the idea of porous building is one, and that's more about the classic attitude of seeking light and air, especially in residential architecture. Another one might be flexible framework. So whether you're doing an actual modular project or whether you're doing something where a client needs a high diversity of unit types, can you build a rational framework that can plug in a number of different unit types stacked vertically that has more diversity than you otherwise have in conventional means, or functional facade? You know, is there a facade, a memorable facade moment, you know, an idea, a concept that people can clearly see that has true function and value for an occupant? Or micro shifting. We talk about sky glass. We have a tower floor plates that micro shift between floors, especially in tall buildings. What kind of value do they bring? Site pluralism is just a take on base, middle, top. So we have all of our own language here of these down-home, everyday kinds of architectural strategies that we found to be useful, and we apply them to sort of new work. And I think that kind of ethos, I guess, if you will, resonates pretty strongly with clients. And we've, I think, found success in the projects that have been realized. And so, you know, the idea of project-based learning revolving around these concepts has been really helpful for us. And I think that really is the fundamental thing of what studio means for us. Yes, pin up drawings and have those kind of critiques, but it means how do you think about your work and what are the foundational ideas that's rooted in it.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. As an architect or firm owner, you might find yourself swamped with drawings that take up most of your day, leaving you with little time to manage your business. MGS Global Group can lighten your load by handling all of your drafting and rendering needs. Their experienced team of architects and designers can convert your schematic designs into DDs and CDs with minimal supervision. With expertise in industry-leading tools like Revit, ARCHICAD, and more, MGS is the perfect partner for managing your project spikes and urgent tasks. They work as an extension of your team and follow your standards to ensure the quality and accuracy of your drawings. Having served sole practitioners, small firms, and publicly traded companies since 2008, MGS guarantees you get the help you need right when you need it. Visit mgsglobalgroup.com and book your free consultation today. That's mgsglobalgroup.com. ARCHAT's Spec Wizard is the tool that will help you save time writing specifications. Going through the manufacturer's specification line by line to find the right product leads to frustration and errors, and that's where Spec Wizard comes in. It's a free, patented tool that allows you to select products and options error-free and generate a three-part specification in minutes. Go to ARCHAT.com, that's ARCHAT.com, and try Spec Wizard today. Have you developed a system for that? I mean, it's great that you have these seven ideas, but how do you actually collect those ideas and sort of filter out the ones that are not going to become those ideas?
Yeah, we keep hold of the reject ideas because sometimes they'll come back. Well, one thing we do, we sort of organize them in sort of this genealogy tree.
Oh, interesting.
So we'll have a diagram, and Emerald really was a sort of a formative one. It sort of had this idea of site pluralism because how does a tall building meet the street? And its form is sort of shaped by the shifting grids of the street itself, in addition to having to do some really strong technical things structurally and mechanically, all of the services that had to sort of find their way in this sort of tiny footprint to expand out over the building. But this idea of how you design at the base of the building versus, you know, what's the context and what are the design cues for the broader scale of this building, because tall buildings operate at these multiple scales, you know, they have a sort of a citywide scale to them as well. But we can track that idea. What was site pluralism to Emerald and what is site pluralism to Skyglass? And they're going to have different variations of that. But sort of making that genealogy tree, I think, was really helpful for us to do that and sort of make that visible. And, you know, different variations of things that we can set aside. Some of it does, you have to rely on being here. And, you know, like, remember that time when we worked on X, Y, and Z? Let's pull up that information. Let's reevaluate that. I think it could be useful here. So, you know, again, when I'm sort of talking to prospective candidates about pathways to success, and if I can give them advice, is if you're working on tall buildings, that might be a 5-year project, you know, sometimes even longer. And, you know, to gain experience from beginning to end is really valuable, but it sort of takes a commitment that has some years to it. And when you do, then you will learn, you know, because projects are designed and realized in parallel. You know, we might have multiple projects happening at one time. And so if you can have a core group of people who understand where we've been a little bit and what we've tried, that's really useful to us. And I think the other thing that really helps us is that we're a relatively small group. You know, if we have 15 to 20 people, we can do a lot. I wouldn't imagine us, the architecture studio, to be anything more than 35. Because I just imagine, you know, when do you stop being a studio? And it's not like you just sort of dial that, right? There's all kinds of luck and sort of things out of your control that sort of has a say in the amount of success your firm has. But I think that's part of it. We graphically do it. And I think the other part of it is Sean and I are very actively engaged in the work. So we can direct it and we can sort of bring up these past precedents of our past work that might be relevant for current work and so forth. When I have an interview for candidates, I tell them straight away, okay, what are the things that I can tell you to help them with their decision? Like, what is perhaps maybe a little bit different of how we do things that might be different from other offices? And that's really just in the spirit of whether or not we're the right fit for you, right? Nor do we want to be for everybody. And I'll say this, we're not going to be for everybody. You might have different things in your career that you want to seek. That's totally great. And there might be firms that are more aligned with your values. Fantastic. But let's talk about what our values are, see if they align or not. If not, you know, how can we help you sort of point you in the right place to go to where, you know, might be more applicable to where you want to be. So for us, what I'll say is, what are some of those things that are differentiating us? And, like, you know, Sean and I are in the projects. I use the same BIM that everyone else does every day. In those models, we use physical models and we used hand drawings and all kinds of things, but we use BIM from day one. And that's something I grew up with since I was 17, you know, working in architects' offices. So I'm in the same digital reality as everybody else and understands that reality pretty well. And so I think, you know, it comes to a studio, it's a very hands-on experience that Sean and I have with our people who are different stations of the career, whether just starting out or at mid-level of their career.
It sounds like a very healthy, positive, productive culture.
We try, and the group we have is that, absolutely. It's probably the most important thing that I'm looking for when I'm interviewing candidates is not, are you positive and healthy in your sort of perspective, but again, it's the alignment of values. So I design the interview, and I have the same format for every candidate so I can compare. And what I'm really looking for is what motivates them, what are their values and what motivates them. I think that's really important. I mean, we get the portfolios, we get their work, we can discern a lot about their work and whether we think their work is something that is complementary to what we do. And then if so, let's go chat with them. And we do that. But really what I'm after when we're having that chat is what motivates them. I'm a very task-oriented, hands-on, action-oriented kind of person, much more itchy if I'm in a sort of big group of people. I can be in a big group of people where we're developing a consensus, where not necessarily any clear action is supposed to take place. We might be offering perspectives and that can do that. But what motivates me is this sort of very hands-on, task-oriented kind of thing to sort of make positive, meaningful contributions to the human experience in the built environment. And so I'm looking for people who share that, you know, and they can be from all walks of life, but do they share that fundamental motivation? I think it's really important. So I'll have the same format of interview. I'll try to tell them very straightforward that we might not be for everybody. I'll ask them the same 5 questions. So I'm looking for certain answers of how they answer those questions. We try to do it in a half hour. We can always come back and have a second interview. I think there's a lot of people who rise to the challenge and are excited about half hour. Great, let's do it. That tells me a lot. Right? That they're sort of motivated that way versus people going, well, that's not a lot of time. And I had a couple of that, but that tells you something, right? That tells you something. And so yeah, the environment's really important. And that leads to our Be Principled core value. And what Be Principled really is, there's language in that. And I like the fact that, you know, Sean was of the three core values, Sean sort of had more contribution to this one and had the most words, right? Which I think was kind of funny. But the operative language of Be Principled is, yes, it has language about treat others how you would want to be treated yourself. But it really is sort of underscoring what I mentioned earlier about what I think a lot of people who study architecture realize is that we want to be critical and challenging of our work. Absolutely. We don't want safe space for our work. We don't want to be critical and challenging of people, right? There's a big difference between that. And I think, again, if you study architecture and you work in architecture, you understand that because that's what we've been doing since we started. But we do want to underscore that, that we want to be critical and challenging of our work. And not all of the ideas that get put out there are ones that we move forward with. And that's okay. Set them aside. And I tell people that all the time. I've put forth ideas to clients, and for one reason or another, a piece of information that we didn't have before became visible and sort of made that idea not really so hot. So super fine. We'll just solve it another way. And so Be Principled really is about knowing that difference, knowing the difference of like absolutely critical and challenging of the work, not of the people. And I think, again, I don't have to have a studio that is appealing to everybody. I just need the right 25 people.
Yeah. I love that, that you've defined what your studio is, and there are some people who are going to resonate and gravitate towards that, and that there are some who are not. And that makes it very clear on whether this is a good position for this person or not. One of the big trends right now in architecture since the pandemic is the idea of remote studios and flexible hours and all the things that come along with remote studios. I'd love to get your thoughts on remote studios and flexible hours and the sort of the flexible structure that comes along with those kind of things.
Yeah, great question. I'm laughing because I have experience with being in a remote studio. You know, our Skyglass project had its second and final public approval meeting 2 weeks, 3 weeks before lockdown in the pandemic. So we spent, you know, finishing permitting and the construction through the pandemic. I also taught a design studio at the University of Washington. You know, I've been doing that since 2016. So our fall studio in 2020 was all remote. And I'm glad that that was the only time that we had an all remote studio at the university with 12 students. The university, the following year, because I teach in the fall, so we were all back. Windows were open and we had other things happening in fall of 2021, but we were all back. And I think it sort of recognizes when you're doing very complex creative endeavors that are one-off situations with, you know, sometimes if you include general contractors and core consultants and specialty consultants, you know, talking well over 100 people, it's very difficult. It's certainly not as efficient to do it in a remote situation. Now, there's value in a remote situation, as you mentioned, flexibility. And there's also value in having time for uninterrupted, dedicated time to work through issues that requires discipline and consistent thought versus everything can't be sort of with large groups of people. And I think the pandemic had made that much more visible that you really do need to have these kinds of things. But in general, we want the critical mass of the work to happen here. And new people who are hired here, we will say that, you know, we have some flexibility with certain key people for certain reasons, but the default critical mass of energy and effort happens in the studio. We also have been encouraging my partner, Sean, when we write our RFPs for consultants, that we want to have a certain percentage of meetings that have to be face-to-face. They have to happen here. I've seen too many meetings where, you know, people can get short when there's a distance. People, you know, there's just the communication is just not as effective. I know there's a lot of ink being spilled on the value of remote work, and there is some value. I get to talk with prospective candidates from all over the world. And that's really great. And one of our projects, we're partnered in 2019 and through the pandemic with Herzog and Demiron. So we're working with people in Basel all the time. And that remote situation works really well when you have a large firm like that, but legendary design firm like that, they have to get really good at some distance communication with their teams. So it is possible, but it is not the most effective way to do it. It's not really sort of the studio. So for quite a long time, I think since we got vaccinated, we went to a hybrid situation. And so requiring people to be here 3 days a week. And we want to slowly sort of move them into 5 days a week with a certain understanding. There's a flexibility when things in life come up, that's for sure. I kind of like sort of pay attention to this topic. I think it's a great question. I pay attention to this topic. And we ask all the time, man, what are you doing in your office? To some of my colleagues who are running their own practices, and we really want to find out what's happening. And when it comes to knowledge work, there is all kinds of knowledge work. And some of that knowledge work might be more conducive to a remote situation. I think for this particular knowledge work, it's not. It just isn't.
Yeah. And everything that you described in the beginning of our conversation about the studio and how it works and the benefits of it and the principles that revolve around it are all based in the idea that you are in the same room, in the same space, doing the same work.
And architecture is hard, right? And so if you have a young person, and you know, I've had these conversations with people, you know, they'll say, I'm going to be remote, but I'll be here for you. And I'm like, no. You need to be here. So I'm here for you. I want to ramp you up to you becoming an expert much faster, you know, 10 years to expertise rather than 15 years to expertise. So it's not whether you're here for me, it's whether I'm here for you. So you can learn about like what I'm up to, sort of lead by example. I'm a believer in it, but to a point, I think sometimes people really do need sort of that direct guidance about things and sort of the everyday sort of walk by, hey, you can do X, Y, and Z. It's just so much more efficient and you get to know the people and it's just that collegiality that I think is really important. One of the great things about studio, right? There's an energy there that we really want to capture and foster.
And the serendipity that comes along with being in the same space.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. And there are, I know many, many firms who have gone full remote or have built from scratch full remote and are super successful, have great cultures. They've just built them around that, which goes back to what you were saying earlier, that your firm is not for everyone. And so someone who's looking for that isn't going to find it at Hewitt, but they can find it somewhere else and they'll be really happy.
Totally okay.
Right.
Right. And the thing is, firms come in all shapes and sizes and have different sets of values, and they really are different. Even if they're doing the same building type, they really are different. And so, yeah, go and talk to people. And that's what I'll say. It's like, I'll tell you as much as I can that maybe you can't discern if you looked at our online information or social media or whatever, but you ultimately have to make a decision that's what's best for you. And all I can tell you is like, this is how we think it works here and where we want to go and why we're doing what we're doing. And, you know, it might not be for you. It's okay. Yeah, it really is.
Right. So as we wrap up here, Julia, before I ask you my final question, I want to dive a little bit into the future of creativity. Because you teach, so you're talking to students, so you're sort of looking at how the practice works and how the future of practice will continue. What are your thoughts on how architecture will be practiced in the future?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's kind of fun when I get to teach at the university because I have 12 students and it's like, I love what I do. And what I tell them is, if I have 12 students, there's like 12 architecture stories that I'll see through a quarter, right? So a 10-week quarter. And I don't know what the end of those stories are, right? But in between all those stories, I do get to share sort of a practitioner's point of view. And I get to sort of share, you know, sort of in a sort of down-home mentorship kind of way, which I like to do as things happen, not sort of like year-end review kind of style of like what it means. We actually even taken our studios on site tours. So they've seen during construction, you know, some of the high-rise projects, and that's really a lot of fun too. But, you know, one of the things of, you know, the future of architecture, and that has sort of like, you know, what are the technologies going to be like and artificial intelligence, things like that. I was asked that question about artificial intelligence and, you know, and there's very accessible ones that we all know. We know ChatGPT, we know sort of Midjourney and things like that. I wrote an article for Council of Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat on artificial intelligence because someone asked me, hey, what do you think about text to image AI? I'm like, I don't know. So I sort of tested it out. And then how do I apply that to what's relevant to me and sort of the years of experience that I had? And it turned into an article that got published in one of the journals. I'd landed on a point that I didn't see it as an existential crisis at the moment for how this worked, but it had a usefulness to it, but not as much as you might think, but it was an ability to think big. So what I did was I sort of had this common thread that text to image AI has that architecture has always had. There's always been conceptual only kind of thinking. If you think about French Enlightenment, you know, sort of Boulez and sort of the cenotaph of Newton, you know, sort of this big spherical building, that was that really thought of as a realistic building, or was it this conceptual sort of thinking that I think is valuable to the profession, to the discipline? And I also sort of tied it to Archigram, you know, in the 60s and 70s. And a lot of those conceptual sort of ideas had a lot of value of how we think about the built environment. And some of those kinds of ideas found their way into the Pompidou Center and things like that. And so that's where I think currently text-to-image can give you a feeling, it can give you an idea, it can give you a concept that very quickly is something that people can see, especially broad audiences, you know, if you're sort of working with community groups, that there is some value, but maybe not kind of like, I don't see it sort of, you know, at the moment. It's not a replacing thing. It's adding another team member. It's not taking a team member away. But the really important thing that I try to think about the future of architecture, future of built environment, like where is it important to focus on? And I immediately come to, and I tell my students, you know, if you're alive in 2008 and beyond, for the first time in human history, you're living on a planet that's living in places that are more urban than rural. And that trend, according to the UN, is going to continue. We're continuing to be a more urbanized planet. And that's good, right? There's certain densities, there's certain sustainable kinds of things. So when you think about what's really important right now, income inequality, climate change, affordable housing, all of those kinds of things. And you think about the work that we do, which is driven by private side real estate development, economics, which is most of the fabric of the city, right? And what is driving the fabric of the city of where most people live, work, and shop? And how do we tackle these big issues? Well, it happens doing these projects for private side real estate development. That's the majority of cities, the majority of the urban areas, the majority of places where people are living. How important is that if you want to focus on these really important ideas like affordable housing and income inequalities and climate change? And so I'm sort of making a pitch about the importance of mixed-use residential, whether it's tall buildings of 30 to 40 stories, or whether it's even seven-story projects, or whether it's even four-story projects, that you are front and center of some really big issues. And the really important part of this is, I'll tell them, policy is not enough. Building best practices and technical approaches are not enough. Simply making space is not enough. In order for this to be a viable thing, we have to add poetry to the spaces we make. We have to make spaces where people want to be. And so, you know, it's really important that the fabric of the city takes some of those capital A architecture ideas and makes a sort of those poetic responses. And we think some of the work that we're doing, like Skyglass and things like that, starts to point in that direction. And we're really excited about that.
Yeah, that's so good. I mean, it's so true that design is not optional. Right? Design and creativity and beauty is a requirement for this to work.
Yeah, we want things to be completely engaging and memorable and inspiring and maybe even spiritual, right?
Yes, yes. I love it. So final question, what's one thing a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
It's really easy. As soon as you said it, it was really easy. Be smart, be creative, and be principled.
Exactly. I love it. We'll leave it right there. Julia Nagel is her name. You can learn more about Hewitt and the work that they're doing at hewittseattle.com. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Julia, this has been a really interesting conversation. I really appreciate you coming by, sharing your story, sharing your work. You're a fantastic storyteller. I love your stories. So I appreciate you for coming by here and sharing them here at Entree Architect Podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation as well, Mark.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link to this episode with a friend. Either just click the share button or highlight the URL and send the link to this episode with a friend, because that's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Throughout the 10 plus years of Entree Architect, that's how we've grown, architect to architect. So I would love for you to share this episode and all the episodes with one friend every week. We'd love that. And thank you to our sponsors for this episode. We don't have an episode if there's no sponsors. So thank you to our sponsors. Links to those sponsors, which you should go visit and click, and all the resources that we discussed today for this specific episode, they are all available at entrearchitect.com/podcast. every episode that we've recorded is there, entrearchitect.com/podcast. Go click the links to the sponsors and say hello. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. You should go visit that at gablemedia.com. That is the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to select episodes of this podcast, Entree Architect Podcast. Yes, AIA CEUs for listening to a podcast. It's there, and many other podcasts are there as well. And you can listen to all of them and get credit. Learn more about our program, Gable Members Program, at the gablemedia.com/members website. That's gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, join us today at Entree Architect Network. That is the worldwide organization for small firm entrepreneur architects. If you own your own architecture firm, you are an entrepreneur architect. You are an Entree Architect. With weekly live group business coaching, yep, we have business coaching there, monthly live business training with AIA CEUs, 2 a month, so 24 AIA credits per year, including 12 of those are HSWs. We have them in the membership. Business resources, all the resources you need to run your business, special session webinars, mastermind groups, and a thriving community of small firm architects just like you. Hundreds of architects are there waiting for you to join. So we provide the support and encouragement you need to succeed as a small firm architect. I know that you haven't been trained as a business person when you launched your firm. That's what we do. Come learn how to run a business at Entree Architect Network. And today you can go join right now for free for 30 days at this link, entrearchitect.com/30days. We'll give you free 30 days for membership. Go check it out at entrearchitect.com/30days, and I will see you there. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I want you to remember 3 words: love, learn, share. Have a great day.
I've mentioned it to my family, but in terms of telling people like, oh yeah, we're doing this, I'm looking for projects, you got anything? Yeah. I'm not there yet because it scares the shit out of me.
Dreaming of launching your own architecture firm? Well, buckle up for a wild ride with Emerging, the podcast that shares what it's really like to start an architecture firm.
Where do we begin? We don't even know what type of business to formalize as. Is it an LLC? Is it an LLP? Like, how are taxes? I mean, the list is astronomical.
Season 1 featured founders Jeffrey, Lexi, and Chris, owners of Level Studio Architecture, are your fearless guides on this unfiltered journey from napkin sketches to a thriving studio.
One evening, stumbled into one last dive, we sat at the bar and pondered our postgraduate futures. Amidst the conversation, a napkin became the canvas for our aspirations, sketching plans and milestones, sealing our heartfelt commitment and shared dreams.
In drawing down dreams on a napkin collectively, that then, you know, in your head, you've rooted like, oh, I'm connected to these people, like, long term.
The process of starting an architecture practice brims with excitement and challenges, demanding meticulous planning, flawless execution, and unyielding resilience.
I kind of hate the term because it's so overly used, but I think everybody knows imposter syndrome. And I think it's so real to this day. I don't know if it's with everybody, but with me, I'm always questioning like, us, can we do this? Are we ready to do this? Are we prepared? Can we do it?
Did we just decide a name?
We did it, guys.
Oh my
God. That came out of nowhere.
Woo! It came out of nowhere. I liked it. I saw it.
Ready to turn your aspirations into reality? Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Emerging and chart your own path to architectural success.
Calling all small firm architects, it's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my 2 favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. So for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success.